Well, is there anything going on at the moment in the world? Ha! Welcome to 2026, ladies and gents. Another episode, our first exciting installment of the year of Josh versus the News. Venezuela, Trump, the end of American exceptionalism, or as I like to call it in a little theory I've been working on, the big dick, little dick theory of American militarism. Bear with me. I'll come to this in a moment. First of all, Happy New Year. I was going to say happy holidays, but apparently that's anti-Christian. So Merry Christmas. And also it was a while ago, so maybe not. Happy Australia Day, if you want to get yourself into some real heat. That's coming up in a couple of weeks. Huh. For those of you not in Australia, we happen to celebrate the National Day on the anniversary of the invasion, the conquest of the First Nations people by the First Fleet. An impolite day on which to celebrate our national founding, since it wasn't really the founding of anything apart from when Europeans first showed up here. The pickle is that the date on which the country was actually founded is January the 1st, and nobody wants to have a national holiday on January the 1st, and many people don't want to change January the 26th anyway. I just say, just pick a random day any time in the year and make up some bullshit pretext for it and be done. Nonetheless, my thoughts about Venezuela. Oh, before I get there, do you realize that we are now closer to the second half of the 21st century than we are to the 20th century? Like, we're closer to 2050 than we are to 1999. So, talk about being in the future. I mean, not only is it futuristic to be in the 21st century, but it's even more futuristic when you're closer to the second half of it than the previous century. Is this month, January 2026, the most consequential month of Trump's presidency so far? You could argue perhaps. It's certainly the most consequential, I think, for American foreign policy in more than 20 years, probably since March of 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq. Sorry, not just the United States. Not just the United States. The coalition of the willing. The United Kingdom, Australia, and don't forget, Poland. If you don't get that reference, during the presidential debate between George W. Bush and who was it? Was it John Kerry? John Kerry in 2004. Kerry, the Democrat, was being critical of George W. Bush's isolationist intervention into Iraq and the troubles that the Iraq War was having a few years in, and he said it was, he said, we've gone in with only, like, England, and I think he mentioned Australia. It was like just a few countries, and George W. Bush came out and was like, he forgot Poland. Like, it was, like, how could you possibly forget the indomitable force of the Polish military, without which the United States would be helpless. I think Kerry called the coalition, instead of the coalition of the willing, the coalition of the bullied and bribed, which was more apt. So anyway, probably the most consequential month of American foreign policy and maybe global international law since March of 2003. It is still more than 3 years until Trump is out of office. Believe it or not, he's been in power less than a year. Next week is the anniversary of Trump's inauguration. So on the 20th of January, 2029, my God, that sounds like a long way away, doesn't it? 20th of January, 2029, which will be the first day that he's not in office, and I'm not going to go into like, oh, he's going to run for a third term, he'll become president again, for all kinds of other reasons that we can talk about on another day. I think that's very unlikely, and I think the constitutional system will hold. I don't think he's going to run another time. So on that day, when he leaves office, this particular operation in Venezuela, it strikes me, is going to be fundamental in deciding and determining, and our reaction to it is going to be fundamental in deciding and determining whether or not he leaves office with the world completely reshapen. And maybe the United States of America looking very different in terms of its territory globally, and maybe even having territorial disputes over who owns Greenland, for example. or whether or not this turns out to have been a blip. My goal is not to be more insightful than the people who've spoken on this subject in the past week since it happened. Did it happen a week ago? Happened on the 2nd of January. Is that right, Jono? I think it happened on the 2nd. What's the date today? Where am I? Who am I? Who am I talking to? It's the 12th, apparently. Like 10 days. It's holidays in Australia. It's summery. I mean, the mere fact that I'm even sitting here talking to you people, I would rather be doing nothing else, to be honest. I love chatting with you. I love seeing your pretty faces in my mind. I can't see you. But, you know, seeing you chat on the Substack and on the YouTube and all the various places we're streaming to live. I honestly would rather be doing this than, sitting at home with my kids, trying to entertain them? Boring. You know how tiresome a conversation with an 8-year-old gets? I can't even talk. I mean, I start to talk to them about, like, the Monroe Doctrine. And my 8-year-olds are like, what I wonder if Peppa Pig's on. And I'm like, shut the fuck up. We're talking about the Monroe Doctrine. So they're no good to me. And so, cut me some slack. I'm rusty. It's been, if you live in the Northern Hemisphere, it's hard to understand just how laconic Australian summers are because they coincide also with all the holidays. If you imagine Greece in August, and that is Australia between about mid-December and Australia Day towards the end of January, because we not only have the summer holidays, we also have Christmas and New Year, and so everyone's flat on their back, like a lizard drinking, as Australians say. Why? I don't know. Steve Irwin probably invented it. So my goal here is not necessarily to be more insightful than the people you've heard talk about this over the past 10 days. I just think, and sometimes when I do these editorials, it'll be my initial reaction to something. You know, the morning after the Bondi terrorist attack, I'll just come on and I'll just dump my brain because I think that it's sometimes useful for us all to just articulate ourselves and hear us think and hear us flesh through things with our sort of first draft of history. And then on other occasions, the day after, I have nothing to say because I'm up in the hinterland of northern New South Wales frolicking in waterfalls as I was on January 3rd. And so I have to wait until I get back. And hopefully by then there's a slightly different utility in this, which is that if you lead a busy life and you're not a professional journalist and you just read a few headlines or you just see what's coming across your Instagram feed, you may have less time and less interest, frankly, than I do in reading a lot about it and listening to a lot about it and then trying to kind of sort your thoughts out about it. So hopefully I can do the digesting. I'm a mastication tool. I'm like some, think of me as like a bacteria in your gut that helps break down food for you. I am the bacteria of world news helping you to break it down, digest it, and then I vomit it out. I regurgitate it like a charming little fly vomiting on food directly into your ear holes, ladies and gentlepersons. That's what I'm doing here. I am regurgitating nuggets of truth into your ear holes. So enjoy that. One last beef about the way this is being reported. If you're not a fluent Spanish speaker and you're not a professional journalist who spends a lot of time trying to get all the name pronunciations of all the world leaders and capital cities right, can you stop saying Venezuela? And can you stop saying Nicaragua? Can you stop saying Maduro? Can you stop saying Caracas? Come on. What are we doing here? There's too much of this going around in the media. Just talk like a normal human being. I mean, I sometimes get criticized for this, but I feel like I'm a journalist, and so I have to do it. I think it's important to say things the way that places are actually said. And also, I'm not selective about it. I'm an equal opportunity say it roughly the way that the people who live there want it to be said. New Orleans, not New Orleans. Los Angeles, not Los Angeles. You know? It's Nevada, not Nevada. It was Obama, not Obama, as the Brits called him. Unless you say Emmanuel Macron, if you say Macron, then just say Maduro. If you say, otherwise, just go around and be like Macron. Meloni, Trudeau, Prime Minister Trudeau. Anyway, so Yeah, just stop being pretentious about your Spanish pronunciations, especially Americans, because Americans think that like it's somehow culturally sensitive to make sure that you're saying you have to be pretend to be Hispanic. So Trump's experiments in testing the limits of norms, we already saw those experiments on the domestic stage, I think, in the way that he left office the first time, right? That was a big deal, I think, to claim that the election was fraudulent when there was no evidence that it was, imply that you don't want to leave office, try to install fake electors to come to Washington, D.C. and cause a constitutional crisis on January 6th, excuse me, to try to coerce and cajole attorneys general of states to find mysteriously an extra 1,000 votes here or there to swing the state to him. And then on the day on which the vote count is supposed to happen, put intense pressure on his vice president, who was the president of the Senate, to swing the election, to cancel the votes, to count the wrong electors. When his vice president refused to do so, to encourage violence against the vice president, to encourage mobs to go up to the Capitol building to say that he was going to be there, then to watch the mayhem unfold on television as his colleagues' lives were in danger, as they were running for their lives, and to not tell his fans to stand down. His deranged and delusional fans who were relying on non-facts, on lies that he was telling them about the illegitimacy of the vote. That was a clear instance in which someone was, a chief executive of the country was behaving in ways that were totally inappropriate for the norms. Like, even just set aside the Republican talking point of whether or not there were questions about that election. There have been questions about American elections in the past. I mean, weren't the Kennedys big, like, what do you call it when you're hustling booze and stuff? You know, wasn't JFK's dad like a drug runner during Prohibition? I might be making this up. And nonetheless, they were shady folks, and there were all kinds of questions about those elections. There were all kinds of questions about, like, Chicago mayoral elections. Nothing's perfect. But, you know, the good criminal who's trying to swing an election, when they fail, they just go, well, okay, I wasn't able to do it. And then even if you're a person who in your opponent swings the election, then the remedy is to go through the courts. And if the courts say that they can't find any wrongdoing because the person who stole the election was so good at stealing it that you don't have a leg to stand on, you don't go and burn down the state house. You just pack up and go home. You go, that sucks. I got robbed. It's like, you know, someone steals something from your house. You don't go over and rape them. You don't do that. You go to the cops. So that was a weird. So even if you give him the greatest benefit of the doubt to the people who thought that the 2020 election was stolen, it was still an incredibly inappropriate thing to do and total norm bucking on Trump's part to react the way that he did and to continue to this day to essentially say that he should never have lost power in 2020 anyway. Now we see that same cavalier attitude towards norms and institutions being imposed onto the international stage. And you may recall, dear viewer, / dear listener, you may recall that before Trump came to power in like 2016, that was the big concern. People were not saying, oh my goodness, what's going to happen if Donald Trump gets into power? He might not want to leave office. They weren't saying he might, you know, I don't know, deploy the Justice Department to go after his political enemies. The main fear was about the big red button that doesn't exist except for in the imagination of ad writers and lay people in the White House, which launches nuclear weapons everywhere. The fear was that he's crazy and he has no idea about foreign policy and he's going to get us into a war with North Korea was the main worry. Secondarily, Iran. And the first, you know, Trump administration, the first term, proved that to be wrong. I mean, Trump had always, he ran on an isolationist platform. He clearly wasn't interested in foreign wars. He was very critical of the Iraq war, offensively so, to such an extent that it wasn't clear during the primary process, the Republican primary process, whether or not he'd be able to make it. He was saying things that you really can't say and be elected as a Republican candidate in a primary context. He was saying that people who fought and died for America in Iraq were not heroes, that they were chumps, but that they were sent there for a pointless purpose. That's incredibly taboo among right-wing military families. He said that the war was a mistake. He said that John McCain wasn't a war hero. He would have been a hero if he hadn't got shot down. I like my war heroes not to get shot down, and then right in a prisoner of war camp. You know, these were incredibly insulting things, and he was not regarded as being a pro-military candidate, and he just didn't like, you know, he didn't know much about the rest of the world. He didn't care much about the rest of the world. He wanted to turn America into Manhattan with big Trump skyscrapers on it with his name everywhere. He wanted to make America great, not waste blood and treasure, as the cliche goes, on trying to rebuild the rest of the world. And he basically stuck to that in the first term. And I suppose it was only a matter of time, given that he's now had 5 years in office, before he would sort of start getting restless and accidentally unbox his shiny train set that he was so disdainful of in the first term and take it out and give the train set a whirl. And once he realized just how great the train set of American military hard power was, he would get delighted, and he would jump up and down in the Oval Office like a small child, clapping. That seems to be what's happened. So now he realizes that he's actually got this really cool thing where not only can he write bluster on Truth Social and make everybody worry about whether or not he's going to go to war with North Korea, he can actually just make a call, and then all of a sudden, a whole bunch of other really highly trained people with incredible toys go and do outrageously awesome shit for him in a kinetic spectacle of extraordinary bravery, which he can enjoy the sheen of without having to get his fat ass out of his chair. Well, he could just eat his Doritos and watch. Does he eat Doritos, or is he like my body is a temple? No, he eats Doritos, doesn't he? Or cheeseburgers while he's watching it. You know, on a live stream being beamed down from a US satellite. So he stood by the anti-interventionist instincts in the first term. There are a couple of explanations for why he didn't go there in the first term, for why he stood by his sort of campaign promise not to get America involved abroad. One is that he was surrounded by people who were much more cautious and who believed in going big or going home when it came to American power, like John Bolton, who, you know, would say to him, "Yeah, you can't just use this like a toy. You've got to either go and smash them and then, you know, or don't." The other alternative explanation is the one that I think is worth bearing in mind, and which there's a lot of talk about and which we'll get to in this conversation, which is about spheres of influence in the world and this conception of there being hemispheres of concern, and that foreign entanglements mean American military actions that are outside of the Western Hemisphere, meaning outside of the Americas. And those are the bad ones, the ones where you're trying to solve the problems of all of these incompetent brown people who can't get their act together. That's the Trump perspective, not mine. You know, it's not a foreign war if it takes place in the Americas, because the Americas are the United States' backyard. This is the new thesis. Well, it's not a new thesis, but it's new in terms of being the dominating, exercising theory of American power, which since the end of World War II has been as a global power, not as a regional power. In a strange way, this is a massive downgrade of American power globally, because the whole conceit of the post-1945 world order was that we're going to write a set of rules that are advantageous to us, we, the West. We're going to create 5 seats on the UN Security Council that the victors of World War II will sit on, which will be able to veto everybody else's ability to do anything militarily. And just when the chessboard is sort of set up in a way that is maximally advantageous to our ideals and to our goals and to our interests, we're going to freeze that, and we're going to cast it in stone, preserve it in aspic, chuck it in the freezer. And that's what everybody has to get along with. And if anybody gets out of line, we're going to come and whack them. And that was the idea. And that basically put America on the top of the heap right up until they started pulling at the threads of that, first with Vietnam. But then they rediscovered it throughout the 80s and 90s. And then they pulled more at the thread with the invasion of Iraq. And now I think the thread is completely unraveled with this latest operation. But you can understand the sort of logic of both worldviews. You can understand the logic of let's ensure our permanent hegemony by creating a global system that we sit atop of and thereby maintain legitimacy as the world's superpower, because it doesn't look like we're only acting in our own interest, even though everybody knows that we sort of kind of do. And then the alternative point of view is that whole thing is a tissue of expensive, hypocritical conceits anyway. Let's just be realists about this and look after our own neck of the woods the same way that any other country does. You know, I think it's obvious that that latter interpretation is a downgrade of power, not an expansion of power. But I suppose its advocates would say that it's a recognition of the real way that power works in the world. If you listen to J.D. Vance talking about it or Stephen Miller talking about it, it's all very 19th century. You know, it's like there is nothing but power. Raw power has always been what animates the world. It's like this strange kind of Ayn Rand, like, Übermenschen idea about how the world works. It's like everything is Hobbesian. It's like, I mean, yeah, in the jungle it is, but we're actually evolved human beings who manage to construct complicated societies that subdue those instincts and passions so that we can all live safely and I can walk out of this studio down the street without being worried about being a victim of random crime, because we've established this very delicate network of assumptions and institutions, from the police to the courts, the judiciary, the state, that all, you know, are carefully designed precisely in order to counter the natural state of Darwinian madness that would exist if we were all just, well, when throughout most of human history and in most places. I mean, just look at what happens when you have a breakdown of the state. Look what happens in failed states where young men are just roaming around with machine guns doing whatever they want. That's not great. And J.D. Vance and Stephen Miller and perhaps Donald Trump may be correct in their assessment that that is the natural order of things. But, you know, raping and pillaging are the natural order of things if you don't carefully build ways to avoid them being the natural order of things. And what we did since World War II was go, the natural order of things, as we saw in Auschwitz, can be quite bad. So why don't we not have the natural order of things of raw power, tooth and claw? Anyway, now these guys think they're being insightful by saying, look, this is just the way the world works, so we don't have to keep pussyfooting around with all of this international law malarkey. If it sounds like I'm saying that the international law component of this is absolutely critical, I don't actually think it is. I mean, I don't think abiding by international law scrupulously and tying your own hands to it while nobody else observes it is necessarily, wise or even virtuous. Reminds me a little bit of the way that Israelis feel about the double standard, where everything that their state does that breaches United Nations, you know, code 743G that was passed about the number of buildings that they can build in East Jerusalem or something like that, they get censured for, such that Israel has had more United Nations resolutions against it than I think all other countries combined, certainly than, any country like North Korea or Saudi Arabia. And, you know, the rulers of the enclave of Gaza can come in and slaughter them. And there's no, like, you know, yes, there's a UN resolution against it, but nobody really thinks that that's bad because it's a breach of international law. They just think that that's a sort of semi-legitimate prison break. Similarly, you can see that phenomenon writ large, where anything the West does that is a little bit iffy constitutionally in terms of international law is micro-scrutinized, where constantly, all the time, the Chinese are doing barbarous shit against the Uyghurs and all kinds of horrible shit's going on all over the place, and nobody really cares because those people don't make no pretense to give a shit about international law in the first place. So I do think it's a little bit rich when everyone is wringing their hands constantly about how terrible it is that Trump has broken international law. That, for me, is not the focus of the real concern, especially since it was against international law to go to war in Iraq. That didn't have UN Security Council approval. That was an illegal war. The Gaza war was in many respects illegal. The Gazan atrocities of October 7th were, of course, against international law. Australia's asylum seeker policy is almost certainly against international law. Australian and American support of the Indonesian dictator's invasion and occupation of East Timor for decades was definitely in contravention of international law. Our support for the 1973 coup in Chile and the long reign of terror of Pinochet was against international law. We do, Vietnam War was against international law, blah, 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 on and on. That's not what is wrong with it. But let's just tease out the legal stuff anyway, so we can sort of park it and put it aside before we get to the big strategic and moral stuff that I think is more interesting. One interesting thing about the legal stuff that I heard a really interesting conversation with Sarah Isger and David French on their podcast. It's produced by The Dispatch. I don't remember the name. I think it's Legal Opinion, Advisory Opinions, I think is the name of the podcast. It's a goodie if you're interested in like legal stuff. They're great. I got to get them on the pod. It's a weird thing to parachute into another country and seize its leader on the basis of the fact that you're conducting a judicial arrest, right? And then you take him to a court in New York, a place where has he ever set foot in the United States? Certainly not while he's been doing any of the things that he's accused of doing. So, like someone abroad commits a crime that contravenes your laws, including crimes like owning a machine gun at the time that you were running the drug running operation, which is two of the four charges are about machine guns. This is a way that prosecutors just throw those in order to get maximum amounts of penalties, because in the United States, if a gun is involved in a crime, the penalties snap up exponentially. Hence, Hunter Biden happening to own a gun at the same time that he was an addict, then the crime is just suddenly much, 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 much worse if a gun is involved, however tangentially. So they throw those on, and then they go and they fly into another country and they kidnap him and they bring him home. Now, those things may not be crimes in Venezuela. I'm not sure. The idea that, like, suppose China decided that the Australian Prime Minister had broken a Chinese law outside of China, but it had ripple effects on China and implications in China in some way. Everything does. And so, everything that a world leader does. And so then China, does a covert operation in the dead of night into Canberra, kidnaps the Australian Prime Minister, takes him to Beijing and puts him on trial for crimes that are not crimes in Australia, but are in China. Like, what? What's that all about? It's definitely against international law. There's some question about whether or not it's against US law. The other interesting sort of wrinkle there is that, it's also relevant that the US claims that Maduro was not the president of Venezuela because heads of state have immunity. On the question of immunity, the interesting thing there is that Trump has spent his entire presidency arguing that things that you do as president, you should be immune from prosecution for. And in fact, he won in the Supreme Court, saying, that with this very, very expansive vision of executive immunity, where never before had the Supreme Court ruled so broadly that any crime that a president commits, as long as it was committed in the honest execution of his or her job, is immune, that it's not a crime. So the idea is that if he's doing something that is completely unrelated to official duties, then that could still be a crime. But if it's anything that is in any way related to the ongoing functioning of the state, this isn't the Supreme Court's actual ruling is not quite as broad as this, but I'm articulating the case that the Trump side was making to the Supreme Court, that basically anything the president does is immune from. Then the Supreme Court tweaked it a little bit and said it has to be about the basic functionings of the presidency and of the government. It can't be something that is sort of just optional. It has to be fundamental. Nonetheless, I'm just pointing out that it's a little bit rich for the Trump people to say anything that the president does while he's in office is not criminal, even if it breaks laws. And also, here's this president who's been doing these things in his other country that break our laws, so we're going to go and seize him outside of our jurisdiction and bring him here and put him into the judicial system. The point that Sarah Isger was making was that really the judicial system is not what is not supposed to be doing this. Like, this is not what it's built for. The judicial branch of the three branches of government in America is supposed to be resolving law enforcement, you know, enforcing, so, you know, engaging in law enforcement domestically and resolving disputes between Americans. It's not supposed to be an arm of foreign policy. The correct response when an executive of a country, a head of state, has a beef with something that another head of state is doing is, unfortunately, war. War is the tool that the government, that the executive branch has. They go to the legislative branch and they say, this country is doing this thing that is really terrible. Here are the reasons I want to get rid of them. And then they use the military. They don't use the military to help them, quote unquote, help the Justice Department then find a way to get a foreign head of state into the court system and pretend that it was a simple arrest. That's messy. One interesting thing here is that if the drug running, which is Maduro's drug running, that is, which is the core of the claim that the United States, Trump has against Maduro, if that is part of the Venezuelan government's sort of policy, then that definitely changes the question of whether or not Maduro should be criminally liable for running it. Because it's fundamental to the conception of presidential immunity in any context that if the president is carrying out their duties as president and they break laws in that context, that's very different from if they're committing a crime on the side. And this makes sense. If I'm the leader of a country, and while I'm not technically working as the leader, even though I am the leader, I sneak out of my bedroom in the middle of the night and I go and kill a guy and then I come back, that is different from if I'm the leader of a country and I declare a war in which people with my knowledge and authorization are unjustly killed. You know, we give that second act a pass that we wouldn't give to the first act because leading things is difficult and sometimes compromises need to be made and sometimes mistakes are made. So if Maduro's policy as the president of Venezuela has been, we're going to make life difficult for America and poke America in the eye and make enormous amounts of money by helping drug cartels to get cocaine into the United States, it's very difficult to understand how that can be criminal in a judicial sense. It can certainly be a shitty thing to do, and he can be an awful dictator who is barbaric and deserves to be deposed, in which case you go to war or you do some kind of other military intervention, if short of full-scale invasion. But you don't pretend, you don't pull off a military intervention and then pretend that it's not a military intervention because it's actually a legal proceeding. It is akin to the way in which American military campaigns are no longer wars at all. They don't go through Congress at all. And, you know, there's like this sort of fig leaf of them just being operations. You're supposed to go to Congress. In fact, and this was a point made by John Dickerson on the Slate Political Gabfest, if you recall, just weeks ago, you remember that Vanity Fair piece where Trump's deputy chief of staff, or is it his chief of staff now, gave this incredible interview and there was like a photo shoot and like people were like, oh my goodness, the photo is so close up. You can see the little pinpricks of lip filler on her lip. And she was very, very outspoken about Trump and Vance and her thoughts and everything. Everyone thought it was like unprecedented for somebody who's that close to the president to be giving such a candid interview. And she was asked directly about Venezuela, and she said that if the president, and she's not nobody, I mean, your chief of staff is a big deal. She said if the president wants to do something in Venezuela, he'll have to go to Congress first. She was asked the question point blank. She was like, of course. So what's this whole thing about not going to Congress anymore? The point of having Congress is that you can deliberate and take into consideration consequences for a military action that might outlive the personal interest of the president. The founding fathers of the United States understood that there are going to be different incentives acting on a chief executive than there are on the scores of elected representatives who represent the people in the legislative branch, and that therefore military action should only happen when both of them agree and the president can go to, I mean, that I don't even think they thought that the president should go to Congress. They should that Congress is the, I mean, it's explicitly in the Constitution that Congress is the entity in the United States that has the power to declare war and to conduct wars. I mean, it has the power of the purse strings, so it shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't even be possible for a president to launch military campaigns without congressional approval. But things have gotten so sidetracked and, you know, ass backwards that now not only does the president not go to Congress, and not only does Congress not seek to be involved in any such questions ahead of time, when they are totally excluded, there isn't a peep. There isn't a peep about whether or not they should have been involved in deliberating about the long-term consequences for America and for the region and for the world of one man deciding to do this. So that's weird. And it makes me worry about what the complexion of American democracy is, even if the elections remain stable and we don't have another constitutional crisis, at presidential election time. What does it mean to have a democracy where there's no parliament, essentially? Let's hope that changes later on this year and that the Democrats can take back the House. So you have this. So that's all the legal stuff, right? Yes, it's against international law. It's incredibly fishy to be calling it a judicial thing. I still can't quite get my head around how, I mean, more learned people than me say that it is consistent with American law to be bringing him in because, hey, we did it with Noriega and we did it with, but I mean, so what? You can be wrong a number of times. I don't really understand why precedent is like the ultimate get out of jail free card here. Pardon the pun. Sorry, Maduro isn't getting out of jail. But, you know, so he's there and apparently this is legitimate and there is standing, even though he's not American and he didn't commit the crimes in America. They do impact America. So somehow, the American justice system has the ability to prosecute him as an international criminal, as if he was, like any old common drug running terrorist. So there's all that stuff. And then there's what is going to happen in Venezuela. It's tragic that the opportunity to liberate a people from a horrifying communist tyranny has been so tarnished by the crassness of Trump's attempt to exploit this for personal gain and for American oil interests. I mean, it does make you miss hypocrisy a bit, doesn't it? It makes me miss a little bit the hypocrisy of we're only spreading democracy, only to the places that have oil. The democratic governments thereafter will be able to sell us. That was nicer than just simply out and out saying, we're going to take the oil, we're going to run the place, we're going to share the oil proceeds with the Venezuelan people, as if it was America's to share. It's galling. And it's sad that so many of the great and brave Venezuelans who've been working for years and whose families have been disappeared and who found themselves, hanging up, beheaded from lampposts for speaking out against the government, and the people who've seen that country go from a fairly prosperous place with tons of resources, loads of oil, more oil than anywhere else in the world, loads of gold, a place that had a really thriving and vibrant culture and middle class in the 80s and 90s, to a place where everyone who could leave has 8 million Venezuelans have left, and where the economy has gone backwards to something like, a third of the size that it was. So terrible, terrible, terrible situations in Venezuela while they've been run by essentially this mafia, this deluded, economically illiterate, dictatorial socialist mafia. And it's great that Maduro's gone, but couldn't we have figured out a way to get him gone without all Venezuelans going, well, this is sort of fishy and sucks. It's also strange when thinking about the future of Venezuela that an operation this precise and this limited, this scalpel-like, where the elite forces, the same forces who took out bin Laden, they go flying in there with these incredible gadgets, these amazing helicopters that nobody else in the world has apart from the United States, and they go flying, do some preparatory bombing and they kill 30-odd Cuban guards. And, they trained at a replica of Maduro's palace. So, they built, since August of last year, They have the ability to build the identical. So they have CIS assets in Venezuela, like human intelligence. They have actual spies. And then they have all of their other electrical stuff and their satellites and their drones and everything. And so they're able to actually map the presidential palace identically. And they build it in Georgia, the state of Georgia, not the country of Georgia. They have a facility where they build, they did this for bin Laden as well, where they build a replica of the place and they train on it over and over and over again. And the same people who are going to do the operation go in and they have an actor playing Maduro and they have all of these different scenarios about what Maduro does. What if he pulls up a machine gun? What if he goes into his safe house? What if he does this? And they run it through. So by the time they get there, they're like, we've done this a million times already. It was incredible, the capacity to do this. It's in stark difference to the Iraq war, where it's like, let's do shock and awe and just blow the shit out of the place and then just march into Baghdad. And now what the hell do we do? The problem is, it's like, it's just human nature, isn't it, to go too far in the other direction. Like the lesson of the Vietnam War was we should never do anything else to help other countries in the future. And the lesson of the Iraq war was just don't do anything in the Middle East. And so what happens then, you know, Bashar al-Assad manages to pull off the most horrendous behavior in Syria for the next 10 years after that, because we're just so cautious about getting bogged down in another Iraq that we don't even do the limited things that we could do to save so many lives in Syria. So we're always overlearning the last lesson. And the lesson of the Iraq war was don't just decapitate the government and then prevent everybody who had anything to do with the last government from doing anything, because they're all the people who know how to do shit. The de-Ba'athification program in Iraq after the Iraq war was incredibly misguided and way too punitive. It was compared to denazification in post-war Germany, and the United States basically said, if you were a member of the Ba'ath Party, the ruling, you know, Saddam Hussein's ruling party, then you're not going to be involved in the next government in any capacity. The whole public service is going to be cleaned out and nobody who was a member of the party is going to be there. Well, not everybody was ideologically pro-Saddam Hussein. You had to be a member of the party in order to do anything. It was a one-party state. You couldn't say, I'm not going to join up with Saddam Hussein's club, but I also want Saddam Hussein to give me a job in the sewage system or the postal service. Or, you know, there's so many things in Iraq prior to the 2003 invasion. Everything was run by people who were ostensibly members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party. So when the Americans came in and said nobody who's a member of the Ba'ath Party can have anything to do with the new government, that just led to the entire government collapsing and a massive civil war and nobody who knew how to do anything being able to help because they were prohibited from doing so. So now, being mammals and Homo sapiens and also Americans in this case, we who are particularly prone to this phenomenon of swinging back and forth between polar opposites and never quite hitting the sweet spot, we overlearn the lesson of de-Ba'athification and they say, well, not only are we not going to invade Venezuela and occupy Venezuela, we're not even going to take out anybody except for the president and his wife, and then we're going to leave in power the president's vice president and just claim that we're now running the place and that if she doesn't do what we say, then what? Then what? You know, the assumption seems to be on the part of the Trump administration that because they've gotten rid of Maduro, they can now tell Venezuela what to do and the Venezuelan government will just do it because everybody in the government has seen what happens if you don't obey the Americans. But everybody in the Venezuelan government also isn't a fucking idiot who thinks that the Americans are going to just keep doing what they did on the 2nd of January over and over again. It's a high-risk operation. They specifically wanted Maduro. It's completely implausible that Trump is going to tell the vice president what to do. She's not going to do it exactly, and then he's just going to launch another version and do the same thing to her with all of the risk associated with, pulling that campaign off again and again and again with increasingly diminishing returns. Like, once you've done it, you just take the win. So then you leave Venezuela with every single other person in place, with a military that is still loyal to the dictatorship, and with opposition activists who are terrified and now tarnished, frankly, in the eyes of their countrymen and in the eyes of the government, as being associated with an outrageous breach of Venezuelan sovereignty and international law, when all they were trying to do was bring democracy to their country. So watch this space. It's going to be interesting. It's also going to be interesting to see whether or not the strategic, expectations that the Marco Rubios of the world have and the J.D. Vances have are going to come to fruition. It's clear that Marco Rubio, being a Cuban immigrant, is very focused on socialism in Latin America and in Cuba specifically, hates the Cuban regime, wants it to fall. Cuba has been super reliant on Venezuela. As I said, you know, Maduro's bodyguards were all Cuban. Cuba makes a lot of money from Venezuelan oil that is now going to that's now not going to be able to get. Doesn't make a lot of money. Venezuelan oil is the lifeline for Cuba, which it's now not going to get. So I think part of the strategy here is, Venezuela is the big socialist boogeyman, and if you knock them down, you may get a domino effect where all of the other shitty little anti-American communist states that are reliant on Venezuela also topple. And if Cuba has a revolution and ceases being communist, which has been a goal of, America, ever since before the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, that would be an enormous foreign policy win for Marco Rubio and would arguably vindicate the Venezuela operation. The bigger strategic play, I suppose, is this question about dividing the world into spheres of influence, right? I thought there was a really interesting tweet by Melissa Chen, who I caught up with in London a few weeks ago, just before Christmas. She's fabulous, Singaporean journalist living in the UK. Sort of reasonably pro-Trump, I would say, but not in a deranged way. Just very smart, a very lovely human being as well, her and her husband are just delightful, but really thoughtful. And I just think she always has an interesting take. And she tweeted 2 days after the Venezuela operation, "You guys realize the message that the Trump administration has sent to China, right?" Remembering that Melissa is Singaporean, so she has a better understanding, I think, of Asian geopolitics than I do. She writes, "We went from letting China float spy balloons over the US mainland and not even saying a peep about it when Biden was in charge, to this. Under Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela evolved from a failing petro state into a permissive operating environment for foreign adversaries and transnational criminal networks. China had taken the most advantage out of this situation. There are over 600 ongoing bilateral agreements outlining energy, infrastructure, trade, defense, and strategic partnerships between China and Venezuela." 600 bilateral agreements between Venezuela and China. "In fact, China sold and implemented the air defense system that failed the day of the US operation to capture Maduro. It was Chinese tech. A few hours before Delta Force landed," that's the operation to take out Maduro, "the high-level Chinese delegation was meeting with Maduro at the palace to, of all things, discuss the multipolar world order amid US pressure." I didn't know that. That was, according to Melissa, the operation to kidnap Maduro happened on the evening of a meeting between Maduro's people and the Chinese. "Little did they know," she writes, "that multipolarity was about to take a huge hit. Don't forget also that early on when Trump resumed office, Trump took back the Panama Canal by wrestling it from Chinese control, and just weeks ago some Chinese monuments in a Panama park were bulldozed, triggering rage and condemnation from the CCP. This was a complete reassertion of American power in order to claim American dominance in the Western Hemisphere." Yes, right. Venezuela, oil, China, influence, don't mess in our backyard. Then there was that whole awesome follow-up operation where, I say awesome because it was cinematic. Maybe I shouldn't be so cavalier with my compliments, but the operation where the Americans boarded those two ships, one in the Caribbean and one in the North Atlantic, there was this ship that had been headed for Venezuela and turned around and then went back towards Russia, and it had a different flag carrier, but then they painted a Russian flag on it, and all of a sudden it was being escorted by a Russian submarine and by Russian warships, and the Americans just powered a warship straight up. No, they didn't power a warship. They flew helicopters over it from a nearby warship, and they rappelled down onto it. They seized the vessel, and they were like, "No, you're not getting it. You can't be going to Venezuela anymore. There's a blockade." And there's a lot of conspiracy theories online about what was on the boat. What was on that boat that the Americans would risk World War III, a nuclear confrontation with Vladimir Putin, in order to board that vessel? It was probably the Ark of the Covenant on that boat, or the Epstein files. I think it's quite simple. I think once Trump had made the decision that Venezuela was not going to be ruled by Maduro anymore and that the blockade was going to be in place and that everybody else could fuck off out of the Western Hemisphere, his attitude was simply, you don't get to skirt around America's control over the Americas, including South America, simply by playing pussyfooting around and playing your little games, and you almost get your boat to Venezuela, but then you turn it around and now you're going to be in the North Atlantic and the Americans can't come after us, and we're going to get a Russian escort, and we're going to paint a little Russian flag on the side of the boat, and we're going to play cutesy. I just think Trump was like, no, fuck off. There's a blockade. The blockade is going to reach you wherever in the world you want to go, whether the United States or fucking America. Stop playing games. And Putin, if you want to fuck with us and let's see where this goes. But you can't, don't think that you're going to get away without a genuine confrontation. We're boarding that vessel. That thing was trying to come to Venezuela. It almost came to Venezuela. I don't know what it is. That's our territory. That's our water. Venezuela is ours. The whole region, get out. And we're serious. We're going to rappel down a bloody helicopter and we're going to seize the vessel, even as there is a Russian submarine right next to it. Blow us out of the water and start World War III if you think we're not serious. I think that's all that whole thing was about. And you got to admit, it's kind of fucking cool. Like, it is cool. It's also stupid. I mean, the whole thing is stupid. For the reasons that I articulated earlier about 1945 and global power. So let's just get to that in order to land this plane. The Western Hemisphere, the Americas, of which Greenland is a part. And geographically, did you know that? Greenland is not part of Europe. Geographically, it's on the, like, I mean, you know, what, however geologists put frame this, it's like on the same continent as North America. It's part of, in terms of the geography of the planet, Greenland is in North America. Now, it's weird that Trump wants Greenland so much, as a brief aside, because the agreement with their very close friend and ally, Denmark, is already that the United States gets to have a military base there. And basically, Denmark would always have, and certainly will now, agree to any request that the Americans make of it regarding Greenland. During the Cold War, I hadn't realized that America had 10,000 soldiers stationed in Greenland. They had 17 military bases in Greenland during the Cold War. Now America has withdrawn. America has withdrawn. Not at anyone's behest. America has been allowing its relationship to Greenland to atrophy. They now only have 200 troops there, and they have a single missile defense base there. But if they wanted to ramp back up from 200 troops back up to 10,000 troops, and from one missile defense base to another 17 bases, or 100 bases, or 100,000 troops there, then even before Trump, there's no reason to think that Denmark would have said no. You know, bring in money to Greenland, sure, keep America happy. It helps everybody. I mean, it's good to have troops in that neck of the woods for everybody. So the Greenland thing is just weird. And I really didn't understand it until I heard an interview with Donald Trump by a few reporters from the New York Times. They didn't publish the thing in its entirety because he didn't want to, but they took excerpts and they played it on The Daily, the podcast of the New York Times, while David Barbaro interviewed Michael Barbaro, the host of The Daily, interviewed them about their experiences. And it struck me, when they were asking him about Greenland, it struck me that Trump was quite open about saying that actually possessing it is not a practical goal. It's an emotional one. Like, he literally says it's about pride. It's about pride. And they say, whose pride? And he's like, my pride. He's quite unashamed about it. It's about ego, essentially. And remember, this guy's a real estate guy. The other thing that he says is you can do a lot more with something you own than something that you're leasing. He's not wrong about that. I mean, the world of real estate, would you rather own the property and do whatever you want to it, or keep going to the person who does own it and asking their permission to do what you want with it? If the shit really hits the fan, whose name do you want on the piece of paper saying that it's yours? Your name or somebody else's name who has just given you a promise about how you can use it? So I sort of get that, but it's just a completely impractical thing. I got to say, in the context of the rest of the world that still believes in the international order, finding ways to dissuade Donald Trump from being quite so expansionist and aggressive, the idea that we wouldn't use Greenland as an opportunity to try to push back and reframe and reassert our commitment to the international order is bonkers. We shouldn't make the same mistake that we made with Putin between 2014 and 2020, where we were just too afraid of creating World War III to do anything. I think there's a case to be made for just telling you to, like what Trump just did with the tanker, by actually seizing the tanker in the North Atlantic off the, you know, completely far, far away from North America, but nonetheless asserting his doctrine of controlling North America wherever in the world that doctrine takes him. And, you know, daring Vladimir Putin to start World War III if he objects, there is a case to be made for sometimes playing that brinksmanship game. And the only way that I see creating a limiting principle for the Trump administration that will allow the international order to survive for the next 3 years, should we want it to, and we'll get to that in a sec, would be for the European Union. Because obviously, think about the likeliest way that America could get Greenland, right? And if it gets Greenland, Greenland is a country within Denmark. It's not a sovereign state. It doesn't have a seat at the United Nations, but it's a colonial possession. It's a bit like, if you want to think about, because I didn't even understand until the past week, I've been looking into deeply the legal status of Greenland. It's not like, a lot of people think, oh, it's sort of like Scotland is to the United Kingdom, is like Greenland to the Kingdom of Denmark. It's not, because Scotland predated the UK as a country that had a government. Greenland was a largely tribal Inuit society that was colonized by what was then Denmark and Norway, a single country. And so it's a bit more like thinking about somewhere like, say, New Caledonia in relation to the French. You know, France goes in and colonizes these overseas possessions. So when you think about it being ripped off of Denmark and one of Denmark's countries being possessed by another country, that would certainly rupture the fabric of an agreement that said that country, you know, Denmark, that is, and the United States had a military alliance. So the other two options that America, if America cared about doing this delicately, and it remains to be seen whether they do, they could just encourage Greenland's independence and then have a, you know, create Greenland as a new state. This is not a crazy idea. There's been a movement for this for quite some time. Many people in Europe regard it as being sort of inevitable anyway at some stage. So maybe, you know, as the decolonization process continues, so maybe Greenland just becomes independent and then chooses, quote-unquote, chooses a military alliance with the United States that trumps its relationship to Europe in exchange for a security guarantee, and becomes a de facto territory that way. Alternatively, if they didn't want to do that, or if that was too tricky, or that was going to take too long and Trump wasn't going to be in office anymore, you can imagine a scenario in which the Trump administration just declares that Greenland is part of the United States for all these historical reasons. It's geographically part of North America. And they just send a bunch of warships there to make that a reality. And if the Greenlanders don't want to do what America tells them to do, then they can try to test Trump's mettle. If that was going to happen, I think it's crazy that the European Union now isn't preparing for that eventuality by trying to call Trump's bluff before he gets there. If you really don't want NATO to fall apart, and if you don't want the might makes right ethos to be the only way of doing things globally, then you have to show people that liberal democracy and the international order does have a pair of balls larger than tiny, shriveled, frozen peas. I mean, you have to at least have walnut-sized balls. Like, you know, if the Trump administration is walking around with basketball-sized cojones, you can't just be like, oh, I really hope that he doesn't do anything to, like, invade us and take our territory. What can you do? You could just take all of the warships in the European Union that aren't otherwise occupied anywhere else, which is basically all of them, including nuclear submarines, and you send them up to Greenland on the pretext that you're protecting Greenland from Putin, from Russia. We're all in this together. We're doing it on behalf of everybody. I know that, Mr. Trump, you worry a lot about America, about Europe's contribution to NATO. As a show of goodwill to the United States, we're going to do our bit in making sure that the parts of Europe that are closest to you are well protected and well defended against Russia. So you guys can take care of your neck of the woods, do whatever you want. You don't have to worry about Greenland. Look at all this incredible military hardware that we've got up in Greenland. So that then, if it were the case that Donald Trump wanted to declare that Greenland was part of the United States and he wanted to send a warship up there, he would have to create a hot war by firing on British and French and German and Spanish warships. Now, maybe he would do that. Maybe a world war between the United States and Europe would break out. Maybe the United States would win, whatever that means. Maybe there'd be a nuclear war. But at some point, you can't allow those maybes to prevent you from standing up for anything. Otherwise, you're just handing the future to whoever is the most audacious bully. It's almost like a heckler's veto geopolitically. It just means that anybody who has the most bluster gets to get their way. The whole point of the post-World War II consensus was that we're going to be the ones with the most bluster. That's what NATO is. It's a way of saying to the Soviet Union, it was a way of saying to the Soviet Union, no matter how much bluster you've got, we're so full of bluster that we're taking the bluster out of our own hands and we're making it an automatic trigger. It's like the Dr. Strangelove doomsday machine, which was parodied so well in the Kubrick film, where the Russians had supposedly invented a machine that was going to destroy the planet in the case of an American first strike. And that was going to ensure that there would be peace forever and that nuclear war would never happen because no American leader would be so stupid to launch a nuclear weapon against the USSR, knowing that certain annihilation was going to take place. The only downside was that the conceit of Strangelove, the movie, is that the Russians left a few days in between the activation of the doomsday machine and the telling of the Americans. And in that time, a rogue American military officer decides to launch a single nuclear weapon against the USSR. And when the American president asks his Russian counterpart, what is the point of a doomsday machine that automatically triggers global annihilation if you don't tell us about it when it gets switched on, the Russian military guy says, well, the premier of the USSR was waiting until Saturday's party, his gathering of high officials in Moscow, to announce it to the world. As you know, the premier loves a party, and hence the world ends. You do have to have some of that bluster. Like, you do want to have an automatic trigger. That was what NATO was. And I think the EU has to figure out what its automatic trigger against the United States is. Not against the United States, in favor of the international order, should the United States choose to aggress against Europe. So if it was me, I know the EU is never going to do this because it's like herding cats. But I don't know why Starmer and Macron and, you know, just get them all together. How was my pronunciation there, by the way, of Macron? Starmer, Keir Starmer, we should get Sir Keir Starmer and Macron to respond to Venezuela, to the actions of Donald Trump in Venezuela against Maduro. And they should respond by sending a lot of arsenal up to Greenland and just make it clear that if you're going to attack Europe, then you have to attack Europe, bro. You can't do it on the sly. So that's my goal, create a World War III if he takes Greenland. The last thing to address is what the world looks like when it's divided up into spheres of influence instead of having the United States as a global hegemon enforcing a rules-based world order. I mentioned earlier, it's actually a downgrade of American power. You know, since 1945, America has... In fact, where's that quote from Trump? Oh, there's a really good quote. John, can you see... Oh, here it is. Don't worry, I got it. So this brings me to, yes, I almost forgot, my big dick, little dick theory of American militarism. Let me kick the tires on this baby. I remember an interview with some American satirist, may have been that guy from Minnesota who used to do those whimsical poems and songs and stuff like that. Was his name? Anyway, someone will mention in the chat. And Garrison Keillor. And he was asked by a British journalist about why he thinks Americans are so sort of arrogant on the world stage and have such faith in American power. And I remember him saying that they don't. That is a complete misreading of the American psyche. Most Americans are insecure about their role in the world. You know, when you think about just middle America, you just go into a nice, polite town in the Midwest. You know, if a British person comes in and starts talking, they think that the British person is far superior. They think there are all these cultured, intelligent people out there, you know, partly on the coasts of America, but certainly over on the continent and in the UK. When I noticed that when I moved to America, just speaking with a foreign accent immediately makes a large majority of people think that you think that you're better than them as Americans. Very few other countries have that phenomenon where they feel like they're being talked down to just because somebody isn't from there. It's quite strange. And I think Americans have responded to the... I'm talking about particular types of Americans. I'm not generalizing about 340 million people. Talking specifically about the strain of American nationalism and militarism on the political right, right? That there's a small town, kind of anxious, new world, family-oriented, community-oriented insecurity about things, which has found its antidote in vast expressions of power, in American flags on every flagpole along Main Street, USA, in extraordinary displays of American force and valor. And they feel that this is a comforting way to be in a world that is actually sort of either wildly chaotic and hazardous in all of the shithole countries, to use Donald Trump's phrase, or hoity-toity and fancy-pants and intelligent in the case of Europe, but fundamentally sort of decadent and debased in a way that the United States isn't. So the big dick, little dick theory of American militarism is basically that what the rest of the world diagnoses as American big dick energy is actually a little dick overcompensation, not necessarily in a bad way, but there's a kind of a humility in American mainstream, sort of middle American culture. I'm not talking about Trumpism here, although I think that a lot of these people vote for Trump because they see him as the only expression of their kind of id in their small town way. That we often, yeah, I think we risk misunderstanding American militarism as a gorilla beating its chest when it's actually people who feel like they're somewhat left behind and somewhat powerless and somewhat confused, trying to assert whatever control they have over a crazy world that looks down on them and will look down on them no more if they have 7 billion nuclear-powered submarines standing astride the globe, trying to bring their apple pie and pumpkin pie and, you know, sweet freedom and home cooking to the benighted masses and the hoity-toity fancy-pants Europeans with funny accents abroad. And this has, I've been awakened to this theory because of this new talk in the Trump administration about the Western Hemisphere. And about thinking about the consequences of dividing the world up instead of having a single hegemon. This is what Trump said after the Venezuela operation. Quote to the New York Times, under our new national security strategy, and this is an actual document, he's not talking in airy-fairy ways about the strategy. They published the new national security strategy. It's a very interesting document. It's actually worth reading. It's very anti-Europe. Very anti-European, which brings me back to my big dick, little dick theory of American militarism. It's like Europe is a bunch of fancy pants dickheads who needed their asses saving in World War II, is the subtext, by good, hardworking, simple, plain-spoken Americans who understood the value of family and community and faith, and had to go and rescue these crazy, godless Europeans who always think they're so much better than us. And now what the Europeans have done is they've pissed that heritage up against the wall, and instead of clinging to the only thing that Europe had going for it, which was its amazing churches and its great white civilization that we managed to inherit in the United States, the theory goes, and now they've pissed that up against the wall by opening their borders up and allowing a whole bunch of people with a whole bunch of different ideas and skin colors and cultures in, and they're in decay now because they hate themselves so much. They don't even dare have pride in Western civilization the same way that our, you know, simple American heartland does. We at least still have the American kernel of an idea of pride in what we've built here. And the Americans are so self-loathing that they're just allowing huge, huge industrial, you know, deindustrializing suburbs of unemployed young Muslims to run rampant. And they don't even have the backbone to stand up against it. And this is a narrative that is increasingly popular in Europe as well. You just have to look at the fact that Farage, if there was an election hold in the UK today, then Nigel Farage would be the prime minister. I mean, the default opposition party in the United Kingdom right now is no longer the Conservative Party, but is an anti-immigrant party. Ditto the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland in Germany, ditto Marine Le Pen in France. So this is not a, you know, this is something that's in the air. I'm just articulating all of those things to make it clear that I'm not blaming American conservatives for this worldview, but it's a worldview that has particular purchase in the United States because of the big dick, little dick theory of American militarism. So they released this national security strategy, which was like, Europe is on its way out and America is going to have to step into the void and do business with whoever we have to do business with. And we'll just make shit work. We'll play it by ear, basically. So Trump told the New York Times after Venezuela, under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again. That's the quote. Under our new national security strategy, American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again, Trump told the New York Times. I read that and I nearly fell off my chair. It is so unambitious. American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again? I'm sorry. Between 1945 and certainly 2002, the American dominance that went unquestioned was not dominance of the Western Hemisphere. It was dominance of planet Earth. Between 1945 and 2002, American dominance of planet Earth was unquestioned, unquestionable. And now Trump's ambition, his Make America Great Again ambition, is to pare back the question of American dominance to American dominance in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, who would question American dominance in the Western Hemisphere? Who would even question American dominance of planet Earth except people who want to bring it about, who want to bring about an end to American dominance of planet Earth, namely the Trump administration, people like Stephen Miller, who have a small bore, America first, focus on our own backyard, stop spending blood and treasure abroad. Like, I understand the instinct for that kind of isolationism, and I was never a fan of huge unilateral ventures to remake the world in America's image and try to get Sunni and Shia sects to embrace Jeffersonian liberal democracy and to try to get Afghani Pashto tribes in the foothills of Waziristan to embrace diversity, equity, and inclusion and ensure that, like, what was that? There's a funny anecdote. I think it might be, I don't want to misattribute it, but it was someone who was involved in the reconstruction of Afghanistan after the coalition campaign to remove the Taliban. And they were talking to, like, Hamid Karzai, one of the, you know, the new leaders of Afghanistan back when the Taliban was still not in control and coalition US, British, Australian, and so on, NATO troops were on the ground. And the new government representative said to this Western British, dignitary, I can assure you that we are 100% committed to gender equity in the new cabinet in Kabul. And this Brit walked away and was like, oh, this thing's never going to fucking work. Like, this dude he's Googled what Westerners want to hear, and he's just saying a bunch of words. I mean, of course he's not deeply committed to gender equity, and it shouldn't be a requirement of a democracy in one of the most culturally backward parts of the world. Sorry for saying that, but, you know, we're talking about Taliban-affiliated environments here, incredibly regressive on women's rights, on gay rights, and so on, more than perhaps anywhere else in terms of the actual attitudes of these tribes. The idea that we're going to come in and expect the locals to mouth these platitudes about how important gender equity in cabinet is, this guy was like, this isn't going to work. I mean, you have to allow people to rule themselves the way that they want to rule themselves, not according to whatever metrics we're going to impose on them, which doesn't mean that they should be able to go around chopping the hands off girls who want to learn to read, right? I mean, that should be there's your line in the sand. So I'm skeptical of, you know, US grand intervention to try to overhaul and reshape parts of the world that cannot be overhauled nor reshaped in the way that America wants to. But the idea that America would be the indispensable power, that if the shit hits the fan somewhere, can ultimately bring the weight of military might to resolve it, that was unquestioned. And the reason I say between 1945 and 2002 is because the first time that I was old enough to be aware of an American attack on the image of America as being the world's savior was the invasion of Iraq, where the Bush administration of George W. Bush went to the United Nations Security Council, tried to seek approval to invade Iraq and remove Saddam Hussein, did not receive that approval from the Security Council, and went ahead anyway, thereby openly breaking international law. Now, in some ways, that strategy today seems quaint, because at least they bothered to go to the UN. Colin Powell stood there and he held up a little vial, a little glass vial. Do you remember this? Are you old enough to remember this? And he said that this much, whatever it was, anthrax, could wipe out a city. And that Saddam Hussein had a chemical weapons program and a biological weapons program that, it wasn't anthrax, was it? It was some other compound that they were accusing Hussein of having been linked to. It turned out to all not be true. I don't think as maliciously as some people think. I don't think I don't think Colin Powell knew at the time that it wasn't true, but he probably had reasons to suspect that it was not a slam dunk. But the idea that you would even bother going to the United Nations, that the Trump administration would ever bother going to the United Nations and try to get approval for anything is hilarious, is quaint. So it's incredibly dispiriting to see the ambitions of the United States shrink from being, we're capable of making the world a better place in fits and starts and being committed to an order that encourages people to resolve their disputes peacefully, to nobody will question our dominance of Caracas. Shit, really? That's the best you can do? Bro, no one was questioning your dominance of Caracas, but I guess they felt that China was. So I felt like the vision of American power that held the world together according to rules was never quite enough for imperialist idealists in America, nor for raw power realists. So when I say that there's a big dick, little dick theory of American militarism, it's sort of an alliance between the people who think that American ideals are universalizable and should be imposed at the force of a gun on the rest of the world, and the realists who think might makes right and raw power is the way to exercise influence. They each have some component of this desire to control as a way of compensating for the fact that they feel like America has been shat on and doesn't really have the control that it deserves. What happens to a world in which it's divided into spheres? And presumably, of the three big, I was going to say wealthy, but Russia and China, that's arguable about, three big nuclear-armed powers in their continents, the United States, Russia, and China, presumably the idea is that each one of them controls their hemisphere. It sounds like a, you know, despite the bluster of Putin and Xi Jinping about America's operation in Venezuela, it does sound like a pretty good deal if you're sitting in Beijing or Moscow. The Yanks get the Americas. Moscow gets Europe. Moscow's not technically in Europe, but, you know, close enough. And Beijing gets Asia. So that's fine, unless you happen to be, I don't know, Japan or Taiwan or Australia or Ukraine or Estonia. Like, it's not a great world if the principle is just there are no rules apart from the rules that are set by the most powerful country in any given region. How do we know it's not a great world? Because that's the way the world has been for all of time, until 1945. Yuval Noah Harari makes the point that it doesn't mean we're going to have World War III instantaneously. Let's not be hysterical. What it means is we don't get to enjoy what we've enjoyed since 1945, which is peace and security without high cost of blood or treasure, to keep using the cliche. Throughout most of time, when there were feudal societies, when there were empires through ancient Rome, through look over the course of history, up until we built the United Nations and international rules and the Court of Justice and all these things in the 40s and 50s, throughout all of time, countries have had to spend a large amount of their wealth on their own defense. Like military budgets, even the countries that have high military budgets at the moment, like the United States, they're still pretty low as a share of the total wealth of the country. People used to have to spend 20 or 30% of the entire prosperity of a country on just making sure they didn't get steamrolled by the next guy. And they had to devote an enormous amount of their strategizing and their thinking, people in leadership positions, that is, to ensuring how could we either invade the other guy or make sure or bribe the other guy not to invade us or keep an eye on the other guy. Like, there's always this constant jostling. And we've been living in a fantasy land since the end of the World War II where we basically haven't really had to think about it because we set up this delicate, it reminds me a bit of like, you know, like in a James Bond film or a Mission Impossible film where they're breaking into an art gallery and there's like red lasers all over the place. In the room, and they have to dance between the red lasers, otherwise they're going to trigger an alarm. You know, trying to get anything done on the international stage since 1945 legally has been like walking through a room full of red lasers. Like, there are just so many tripwires to stop you from being able to do anything that upsets the apple cart or that disrupts anyone else's interests. It's like trying to get a development approval through the most deranged local government council in the world. Just an endless amount of bureaucracy of people sitting in Brussels and New York and Geneva ticking off checkboxes about what you can and can't do. And that's great if you like the existing order, which we do, and we should, because it served us well, because we wrote it. It's not great if what you want is a world in which the powerful get to steamroll the powerless. And that's the might is right view. That's the Stephen Miller view. That's the raw power view. That's the Hobbesian view. That's the view of essentially that we should have a globe, we should have an international order that is akin to a failed state. It's 15-year-olds walking around with machine guns. Yuval Noah Harari, I didn't get to what he actually says. He says, you're basically just going to end up with a world which is where it's very, very expensive and very time-consuming to just stay safe. So it just means that medium-sized countries and certainly smaller countries have to spend an enormous amount of money on their militaries, have to constantly be worried and thinking about whether or not they're going to get invaded. And this also comes back to bite big powers in the ass as well. The Economist magazine had a good editorial about how America's might makes right policy is going to come back to haunt the United States too, for a whole bunch of reasons, not least of which is that you can't guarantee that you're always going to be the undisputed hegemon, and you can't guarantee that you're always going to want to impose your will more than, even if someone is less powerful than you, they may just want the thing more. You know, Russia wants Ukraine more than the Europeans and the Americans want Russia not to have Ukraine. China wants Taiwan more than we want it not to have Taiwan. So regardless of the imbalance of power, regardless of who would win a hypothetical war, the reality is America has all kinds of things that it wants to be going on in the world that it is not willing to spend its money and blood on achieving. So a rules-based world order allows you to do that without constantly fighting everybody. It's not good for anyone. It's certainly not good for small powers, definitely not good for medium-sized powers, and also isn't good for world power, for global powers. So the world becomes more poor and it becomes more paranoid if might makes right. On the other hand, I don't want to leave you with the impression that I think that I give too much credence to the idea that, well, if Trump can do it, then all of a sudden, on what basis can we object to Xi Jinping taking Taiwan or Putin taking Ukraine? It's true, we don't have a leg to stand on in those cases if our moral theory of international relations is that big powers get to do what they want in their region, which is a bit of a crude caricature of the Trump thesis, because he thinks that you still need good grounds for it, you still need standing for it, which Putin didn't have, because he was asked about this specifically in the New York Times interview, and he was like, well, but Putin went into Ukraine, and Ukraine wasn't doing anything against Russia. Venezuela has been pushing drugs into our country and has been intentionally coming up with a whole bunch of ways in which it can undermine the United States and break our laws. Like, Ukraine wasn't doing any of that. Nonetheless, it's always going to be in the eye of the beholder. So, you know, try convincing the Kremlin of that. But to go back to my favorite Ms. Chen again on Twitter, I liked this one. I wanted to, by the way, if you're wondering why I'm quoting Melissa twice, she was going to come on the show. I wanted her on the show talking about Venezuela. She's off on some junket and doesn't have a good webcam or microphone, but we'll get her on once she's back home. She wrote the day right after, or the day of, the Venezuela operation, "The internationalist centrist boomer takes are out, and as expected, they're furious about the quote-unquote illegal action against Maduro and spouting on about international law, saying this gives a green light to the likes of Putin and Xi to attack other countries with impunity." "My sweet, sweet summer child," she writes. "One can simply just post the Spider-Man pointing to Spider-Man gif and be done with it, because international law is kaput. Those who've been paying attention know that we've been at war for years, just not the kind you read about in history textbooks. These aren't industrial-scale wars with armies, but non-state actors locked in low-boil proxy struggles and hybrid campaigns that span the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. These militias, insurgent groups, terrorist organizations, and proxy forces operate with covert backing, funding, or direction from powerful states who provide them with plausible deniability. This allows sponsoring states to pursue geopolitical goals, territorial influence, resource control, or ideological dominance without risking direct confrontation or full-scale war. And believe me, they've been pursuing it. The idea that Trump's actions will give Putin a pretext to annex territory, LOL, or Xi permission to, say, seize Taiwan is laughable. They don't need permission and never did. They act on their own accord and on their own timeline." That resonated with me, even as I disagree with some of it. I think it's premature to say that international law is kaput. And I also think it's somewhat cheeky to equate the kind of support that countries give to non-state actors to do their bidding with, either morally or legally, a country actually going into direct war. You know, there are, as I say, I'm going to miss hypocrisy. There is a case for hypocrisy. It's certainly better than just, you know, pretending you didn't fart and trying to minimize the amount that you fart on an aeroplane is better than just farting like a banshee the entire flight. You know, I can absolutely imagine someone coming along and saying, "Oh, this was all hypocrisy. The whole no farting on aeroplanes rule has been dead for a long time. Why, I smelt a big egg bomb just the other day on my Delta Airlines flight from Charlotte." Yeah, you probably did. It happens all the time, farts on planes. It doesn't mean we should remove the general agreement that you don't fart on planes if you can avoid it. And I'd rather you just lied about farting and did it really surreptitiously than just enormous loud farts the entire flight. So, you know, nothing's perfect, but don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. That being said, I completely agree with Melissa that it's hard to imagine, you know, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping not just doing what they want to do and calculating the consequences of, I mean, not that they would do what they want to do regardless of what the consequences are, but rather that the consequences that they would be factoring in would be the thing that would determine whether or not they do what they want to do, not whether it happens to abide by international law. Like, they're going to break international law if they can get away with breaking international law, and they're not if they won't. So if the Donald Trump rule is, I can break international law, but you can't, and they believe that, then they still won't do it. You know, if they believe that the threat is credible. Where does this leave us? I mean, it reminds me a little bit of my feeling after the American bombing of Fordo and Natanz and Isfahan in June in Iran, where they tried to take out Iran's nuclear program. Incidentally, as a quick aside, you know, we could have also talked for just as long as we've just talked about what's going on in Iran, which is fascinating and which is exactly what Israel had hoped would happen, not to bring everything back to Israel-Palestine, but at the time that everybody was clutching their pearls and horrified at Israel's flagrant disregard for international law. This comes back to it again, international law. Whenever Western countries breach international law, it's terrible. How dare they do something against international law, even after, you know, their adversaries have absolutely no consideration of international law whatsoever. So, you know, when they did the whole, remember the pages and the Hezbollah, and then the cell phones blew up, and they had all these incredible intelligence operations that had stretched back long before October 7th that they just pulled off in quick succession, killing the head of Hezbollah, killing, you know, bombing of Qatar and the bombing of Iran, convincing Trump to follow up with these huge American bombs unlike any other to try to set back the Iranian nuclear program. The hope, ultimately, was that as well as neutralizing any threat that Iran, or at least putting it back by 5 or 10 years, any threat that Iran or Hezbollah would pose to Israel, that they might actually show Iran to be a paper tiger, which would encourage the Iranian street to be more courageous about standing up to the mullahs and the ayatollahs, and possibly create a revolution in Iran. So the hope now, I suppose, is that the Israelis and the Americans just allow the Iranians to make this their own revolution, if it can be such a thing, rather than going into quote-unquote help, which only tarnishes the opponents of the regime as being stooges for the Jews or the Zionists or the Americans, which you don't want to happen. But after the American bombing of those nuclear facilities in Iran, when people asked me what I thought about it, I would tend to say, look, I wish that we lived in a world in which Donald Trump wasn't the president of the United States and the Ayatollahs weren't in charge of Iran and Netanyahu wasn't in charge of Israel, and in which international law meant something and everybody got along and there was no Iranian nuclear program and nobody was being occupied or threatened and nobody was anti-Semitic. We don't live in that world. Given that we live in the world that we live in, and we live with a region in the Middle East that is extremely combustible, wildly hateful towards not only Jews, but the entire West, and incredibly harsh towards the people of Iran who deserve liberation, I think it's a bit weird to be super upset about American bombs blowing up nuclear installations. Yes, it's hypocritical. Why does Israel get them, but Iran doesn't get them? Well, it's because Israel is just sitting there doing nothing with them decade after decade after decade. And, you know, there's a legitimate fear that the mullahs would have a different idea about how to use them, would certainly use them, not whether or not they would actually detonate them, they would certainly use them as a bargaining chip that gave them the ability to do all kinds of other conventional military activities in the area, which Israel doesn't do. Israel hasn't unilaterally invaded Jordan for no reason, for any reason. So I feel the same way now. Would it be better to live in a different world than the one that we live in? Yes, it would be better, much, much better to live in the world that I thought that we lived in when I was growing up in the 1990s, where Bill Clinton just played his saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show and we all laughed at Seinfeld doing a show about nothing. We don't live in that world, unfortunately. And I've become much more humble about my knowing about what is right and what is wrong geopolitically. I don't have enormous confidence that my stuffy old center-left international liberal faith in the world order of post-World War II is actually up to the task of managing a 21st century in which rogue actors and the Chinese Communist Party and re-energized Kremlin in an ailing former superpower are doing whatever the hell they want. I'd like to believe that if we didn't have Donald Trump and if we adhered and redoubled our efforts to the international order, we would be able to create a sufficient quorum, a sufficient kind of consensus globally to persistently sideline illiberal anti-democrats. But I'm not as confident of that as I was 10 years ago. And it doesn't strike me as obviously malicious or insane for the Trump worldview, or in fact, indeed, the even saner worldview that Melissa just articulated in that tweet, to say you're living in fairyland if you think that you can bind yourself to rules that nobody else is playing by anymore, and that the world is not just going to be taken by people who play a savvier game of four-dimensional chess than you are while you're tying your hands up with rules that were designed for another era. I think the world will be much poorer and more paranoid and bloodier if the Donald Trump vision of dividing it into regions of hegemony and influence persists. But I don't see how it won't persist, because I'm not optimistic that the anti-Trump forces have a sufficiently compelling or motivational or visceral articulation of what the world should look like to bring enough people along in their wake. We're not really trying. We're not doing a good job of articulating what liberal democracy can mean when it is not hitched at the wagon to sort of this raw power, sense of chest-thumping triumphalism, the little dick, big dick theory of American militarism. If we had a large capacity and commitment to sustain the liberal democratic world order, so large and so committed that it would occlude any attempt by bad actors to bring it down, then I would certainly be behind that. And I don't want this to sound defeatist, because I am still behind that project, because I think it has a more than 50-50 chance of winning if enough of us get on board. But I am less scornful and dismissive than I perhaps was of the countervailing militaristic view, which is more of a realpolitik acknowledgement that bad actors are going to do bad things, and there's nothing virtuous about refraining from getting in the mud and playing that game with them. It reminds me a little bit of the old story that I think I've told before on the podcast. I'm sure you know it. The old iconic story about the peasant farmer in China who is raising a son by himself in a little village in ancient times. I don't know if he's in China. He doesn't have to be there. And they've got a bunch of horses, and his 15-year-old son is riding the horse one day and gets bucked off and breaks his legs. And the neighbors and all the townspeople come over and they say, oh, that's so terrible. What a terrible thing that your son has broken his leg. He's not going to be able to work on the farm, and you're going to get poor. And the farmer goes, well, we'll see. And then the next day, the people from the army come over because they're conscripting all able-bodied young men to go and fight in a distant bloody war where they're all going to get ground up by enemy fire. And they don't take his son because his son has a bad leg, so he can't go to war and get killed. And all the townsfolk come over and they're like, oh, isn't that fabulous? Now your son isn't going to get killed. He's going to stay here. It's great. And the farmer just says, we'll see. And then the horse escapes, and the prize horse escapes while the kid's leg is healing, and runs away, their favorite horse. And the townspeople all come over and go, isn't this horrible? Your horse has escaped. I can't believe that you're not going to have your most productive horse to work on your farm. And the farmer goes, we'll see. And the next day the horse comes back and he's got a whole bunch of great horsey friends. And now they've got five times as many horses as they used to. All the farmer's friends come over and go, isn't this fabulous? So you've now got all these horses who can work your farm. And the farmer just says, we'll see. And you can keep telling that story as long as you want to, making up as many positive and negative things. And every time the farmer can say, we'll see. So happy 2026. Will January of 2026 turn out to be the most consequential year for American foreign policy in a generation? Maybe the most consequential month in Trump's presidency? Will we all be okay? Will the liberal world order survive? We'll see. Thanks. Take care of yourselves. See you next time.